Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Tuesday morning, April 28th, 31 degrees here in Old Town Park City under partly cloudy skies. Heber City reporting 35 degrees at the airport. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. As we go throughout your Tuesday, we're waking up to some winter-like conditions out there with those temperatures at or below freezing in many spots. So be aware of that. You're going to want to dress on the warmer side of things, particularly for this morning. Now, as we go throughout the day, we're expecting a mixture of sun and clouds. There is a slim chance of an isolated shower or two, but I think most of us, and especially most of the day, will be dry across the Wasatch Back. Temperatures climbing into the upper 40s in Park City. We'll see those highs in the low to mid 50s in the Heber Valley. We'll continue with that warming trend with mostly sunny to partly sunny skies for your Wednesday. Again, a slim chance of a pop-up shower in the high terrain, but most of us will stay dry. High temperatures climbing into the mid 50s here for your Wednesday in Park City. We'll see those highs in the low 60s in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Thursday, we're going to see a weak disturbance moving by primarily south of the state, but it may have just enough energy and juice to produce a little bit more moisture across the state. So there's a little better chance of seeing some scattered showers as we go throughout your Thursday. Now, depending on the timing of that, we could see a little bit of a rain-snow mix in the Park City area, especially if that moisture can move in earlier in the day as temperatures will start out below freezing. Otherwise, as we get into the afternoon, high temperatures are expected to be in the mid-50s in Park City with highs in the low 60s in the Heber Valley. So no real issues expected, even if there is a few snowflakes on Thursday. Otherwise, as we make our way into the rest of the week, we'll dry things back out as a ridge of high pressure begins to settle in across the area. That's going to bring us warmer conditions and drier conditions. So look for mostly sunny skies to wrap up the work week. High temperatures will climb near 60 on Thursday in Park City. We'll be in the mid 60s for us on your Friday. Meanwhile, the Heber Valley will be seeing those temperatures in the mid 60s climbing into the low 70s by the time we get towards your Friday. If you've got weekend plans, oh, it's looking pretty nice out there. Temperatures climbing into the upper 60s in Park City with dry conditions, and we'll be in the low to mid 70s in the Heber Valley. That's a look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Shane Scott, along with the executive director of the Utah Association of Counties, Brandy Grace, with details on this week's annual conference in St. George. Research Director at the Utah Office of Energy Development, Tim Kolachik, discusses the future of nuclear energy and safety in Utah. That's prior to next week's Citizens Climate Lobby discussion. Actually, I should say tonight's discussion on nuclear energy in Utah. And from the figure skating of Park City's Spring Show, A Frozen Adventure, I'll be talking with parent organizer Courtney Johansson, along with skaters Dash Williams and Austin Knight. Well, with rapidly melting snow this winter, Park City ski resorts closed 3 weeks early, showing a double-digit drop in overnight lodging. Warmer than usual temperatures in February and March, more typical of April, forced the resorts to do their best to stay open, but less than ideal conditions kept the destination visitors away. Park City Chamber Bureau CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff says the decline was expected.
Looking at those March numbers, occupancy was down about 25%. March was down. We expected that. There were no surprises there. We also expect April to be down about the same amount. We're seeing that in the data as well, down about 20%. When you look at the last 6 months, you look at the season as a whole with the data that we have now, occupancy for the last 6 months was down about 10%.
There is some brighter news. With fewer people skiing, visitors appear to have spent more time shopping, dining, and exploring town, boosting sales tax revenues. Wesselhoff says local sales taxes were up 10% for the month of January.
I think the surprise there was the local spending that was happening during that time, with the local sales taxes being up so significantly. And when you look at that November through February, the majority of our winter season overall, local sales taxes were up 5%. What that tells me is that, you know, maybe when an overnight visitor was coming in, they would normally ski 4 or 5 days of their visit. Maybe they skied 2 or 3, and then they were shopping and spending and eating.
Year-to-date, restaurant tax revenue is down nearly 1%. The transient room tax collections, which fund the chamber's budget, are down 3%, and the recreation, arts, and parks tax revenues are up 2%. Well, the annual Utah Association of Counties Conference gets underway today in St. George. On the phone with a preview, I have the Executive Director of UAC, Brandy Grace, along with Shane Scott, Summit County Manager, in studio. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning. Good morning.
Hi, Brandy.
Hi.
Shane, let's start with you. And just who from Summit County is attending this three-day conference? You're here. Are you headed down?
I'm not going down because I was in St. George last week at the Utah County City Managers Association conferences. So we felt like it would be smart to divide and conquer. Jana Young, the deputy county manager, will be down there, as well as three of our council members. We don't have council this week. We usually have it every Wednesday. So that's canceled because of this conference. We'll have three council members. I think every elected official in the county, I believe, is going. I haven't spoken to two of them, but and Brandy may even know that too. But we have some staff members and almost every elected official, if not all elected officials in the county, are attending this week.
Okay, so why is it something you think it's worth budgeting to send staff to?
Well, for maybe your listener that doesn't know what the Utah Association of Counties or UAC is, it is a group of, there's only 29 counties in Utah. So we get together. It's probably branded mostly as a lobbying group, which it is, but it is not just lobbying. This conference this week will talk about the legislative session for this year, some of the bills that did pass, some of the bills that didn't pass, the lobbying efforts that UAC and the counties participated in together. And it's so that's a very important part of UAC, but it's more than that. There's trainings, there's just getting together with, I see such an effectiveness with the affiliate groups. So when our county clerk gets together with the 28 other county clerks, they can lobby together. Especially, you know, I think about elections, for example. We have had election bills coming at us the last couple of years that have been very, very distressful. And so we've been able to operate in those affiliate groups very effectively. So there's a lot that UAC does, and we find it very effective in those ways.
Yeah, so Brandy, is that how the conference is organized then? Is that each of these, like the sheriffs and the clerks and auditors, kind of meet together as opposed to in one large group?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And maybe just explain a little bit about UAC. So we're actually considered a private nonprofit. We've been around for 102 years now, originally organized by exactly kind of what Shane was describing, some county clerks that got together and decided that they needed to meet more regularly to talk about best practices and what they can learn from one another. And so the Utah Association of Counties was created. And so within our organization, we have what we refer to as affiliate groups, which is those different elected and also non-elected departments. So we have the sheriffs, the attorneys, of course, the commissioners and council members that all break out into their own little affiliate groups. But we also include our non-elected departments, so like IT directors or HR directors, planners, tourism directors. And so we get a good group that gets together, and once in a while we'll have joint sessions where they come together to collaborate on different topics. But we generally have a really good turnout, probably 300-400 people that come to our conferences, just as far as members. And then we get a lot of support from vendors and kind of our state agency partners. Legislators will be there talking specifically about some of the bills that have significant impact on operations of county government.
All right. Well, you mentioned you're a private nonprofit. I don't think I've ever heard that. What does that mean?
Obviously we're viewed as a little bit quasi-government because of the work that we do, but the way that we are organized under IRS guidelines, or classified as a nonprofit entity. What that means for me particularly is I'm very mindful of our revenue sources that we have to operate on. So rather than our member counties pay dues in, but we try to keep those dues really low because we recognize those are taxpayer dollars that affect our budgets. And so in addition to our lobbying effort, we provide other support type programs or services that help our members take care of the responsibilities that they have and that helps generate a little bit of revenue so that we can keep our dues low for members and have funds to operate on.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned it's a membership organization. Do you receive revenues from lobbyists or anything like that, or is it strictly just from the counties themselves?
No, the counties pay dues into us, but then, like I said, we have other programs that we that we administer on their behalf, and each one of those programs we may get a little bit of admin fee off of. And then in addition to that, the state legislature and the state offices recognize us as kind of the conduit to counties. So we help facilitate a lot of statewide initiatives by being kind of the additional staff resource to counties. And because of that work, there are some grants that the state also funds us with.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, I mean, UAC is well represented during the state legislative session. Tell me, though, how this works. I mean, when counties may disagree on a particular bill, how does UAC deal with that disagreement? I mean, who do you side with on a bill?
Leslie, that's a really good point, because that does come up. We have a very diverse membership, from the Wasatch Front to the most rural counties. You know, mostly we're able to get to a place where we pretty well all agree on just the way that counties should operate. But once in a while, there may be an issue that comes up where there's just different perspectives because of the demographic that our elected officials represent. And in those cases, we kind of have a threshold where we have our members vote on the positions that we're going to take on specific pieces of legislation. And if we don't meet an 80% threshold, then we don't necessarily actively engage. And our position is that when we can pretty well all agree, then that's the direction that myself and staff take in our lobbying efforts. If it's too divided, then we won't take a position. But we always maintain that as independent elected officials, counties absolutely can still advocate and lobby for their own interests, but collectively as an organization, we have some parameters in place so that we have direction and try and keep everyone on the same page as much as we're able to.
All right. Are there any top priorities or themes emerging at this year's conference?
Oh my goodness. I would say that a couple that are really top of mind is property taxes. We've heard this for several years now. Property tax bills that just, you know, continue to go up, the housing market and the way that that has affected things. But property taxes are a high priority. And then, of course, energy development. I mean, we just keep hearing about energy development. And a lot of the big developments, whether they're energy projects or, you know, a lot of that demand is being driven by data centers. And a lot of those developments are happening in unincorporated areas. So a lot of county interest there in meeting the energy demands we have, but trying to keep costs low. And so we'll be talking a lot about energy policy this week.
Hmm. Can you talk about some of the breakout sessions that you've got plans? I noticed that data centers is one of them, as well as PIDs. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, PIDs and all types of tax incremental financing. So as we look at the growth of our state and the creative ways that the legislature has allowed a path forward for counties to be able to access tax dollars specifically for infrastructure investment so that we can meet the demands of our growing state, you know, we'll be looking at some of the legislation that has been passed and what's working and what's not working. And affordable housing continues to be an issue. Workforce housing, I know, is an important issue for Summit County specifically. So this conference, UAC holds two major conferences a year. This one in the spring is specifically focused on legislation, and then we hold another one in the fall where we start looking at developing potential positions and policy priorities for leading up to the next legislative session.
Mm-hmm. You know, there seems to be a desire by a couple of counties in the state to enact home rule. Home rule, of course, the power that's granted by a state constitution. So residents could vote this in, or by state statute, what the state legislature, I know, would never do. So, basically, home rule is so that local government can pass laws governing their own affairs without needing specific permission mm-hmm. from the state legislature. So is this an issue that UAC is undertaking?
Yeah, and that's kind of an ongoing issue, Leslie. And I would say in all types of policy discussions that we engage in, a basic principle of UAC and our efforts is maintaining local control. We believe government closest to the people is best for the people. And so as the state looks at issues that they try to solve, we want to be more collaborative while maintaining a local approach to those things. And land use is, you know, something that comes up every single year as developers and others talk to their legislative representatives about some challenges that they're having, and they try to figure out how to move those efforts forward. It seems to be conversations that we're in pretty regularly about trying to understand the challenges, but really emphasizing that no one knows better the issues or concerns in their own community than those local elected officials. And so we really work to protect local authority.
Hmm. All right. So, I mean, this sounds like it has to be done kind of on a grassroots level. I mean, people kind of have to rise up and get the, you know, the petition signed and to get it on a ballot if that's what's going to make it happen. Yeah. Let me see. Shane, do you have any county staff presenting or anyone part of a panel that you know of?
I don't think we have anybody presenting. I mentioned that Jana is attending, and we'll certainly report back on that. UAC is such a elected official led organization. We're different than, say, the Utah League of Cities and Towns, which is not only larger, there's so many more cities than there are counties, but we're partisan as counties. That makes it also challenging. Brandy and her team do a great job of, when the legislature takes a position or passes a bill, it almost always becomes this one-size-fits-all approach to housing or economic development or elections, and that's often not suitable for us as counties. So we really rely on UAC to find those nuances and those differences in our counties. There was a bill for housing, I think it was Ward's bill, that was talking about housing, and there was no tie to like AMI, the way he defined housing affordability was just really would not work for us in Summit County. Maybe that would work in a different county. So it's those kinds of things that we're really relying on UAC, and those are the things we talk about when we go to these conferences, and how are we different and how are we the same.
Yeah, and Brandy, how does the association ensure that the smaller counties have a voice in these statewide policy discussions?
Well, within UAC, I think that it tends to be a little bit the other way around, because there are so many, you know, when you look at the number of classification of counties, counties are defined by population as first through sixth class. And when you look at just the numbers of those smaller counties, they outnumber the larger counties. But we've been fairly successful, as you know, Shane mentioned, it's not a one-size-fits-all. And so we found some ways that on different issues, you'll see it's very typical in pieces of legislation where you'll have a bill that applies to a county of the first class, or exceptions for counties of fourth through sixth class. So we recognize that their needs are just different. And so, finding ways to, we call them kind of we carve out, or, you know, you define counties by things that are unique to them. And we've been able to pretty well move things forward by using that methodology.
Okay. Anything, Brandy, you'd like to tell us in addition to what we've discussed?
You know, I just want to say I am so grateful. It's been an honor of a lifetime to be able to represent this organization at the level that I have. I've I was a county elected official for 16 years before going to work at UAC, and now having the opportunity to lead the organization, it's humbling to recognize the influence that we do have. You know, oftentimes legislation and that whole process can get a little tense, but I'm proud of our organization. I'm proud of our membership. We stick together despite our differences, but it's our differences that make us the strong organization that we are. We're very well respected on the Hill, and it's exciting to get together at these conferences and kind of talk about what we learned and what we can do better and what our priorities are going to be. And I just really enjoy hearing of the unique challenges that each of our counties face, because it's a great opportunity to address those challenges and advocate on their behalf. So I really look forward to being in St. George this week and being amongst the members. There's always this really, really positive energy. And Shane, I'm sure, has a perspective on this as well. But when our group gets together and they're able to share experiences and some of the challenges that they have, there's just something so refreshing about that. And the energy and the vibe at our conference is something that I really look forward to. So I'm excited to be with our members this week.
All right. Well, I appreciate you stepping away from the conference to talk to us this morning. Brandy Grace, again, is the Executive Director of the Utah Association of Counties. And Shane, anything else that you wanted to add?
Well, just let me add to what Brandy just said. And I'm grateful for her efforts, for our partnership with UAC. She's absolutely right that much like the conference I attended last week, which was the Utah County and City Managers Association conference, there is an understanding among those that attend a UAC conference of what we go through every day, how we serve the public, and really the battle wounds of the legislative session. We get out of that session and there's a big collective relief and sigh from everybody. And to talk about that, having had a couple of weeks in between the end of the session and today, it's really nice to talk about that with our colleagues and from other counties, and to commiserate, and to plan and prepare and to do that together. There's just an understanding there that nobody else has. So, but I'm grateful for Brandy and her partnership and UAC and how effective they are in lobbying the legislature on our behalf.
Okay, Shane Scott, Brandy Grace, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you, Leslie.
Well, Utah is exploring nuclear as part of its long-term energy strategy. Tonight, the Citizens Climate Lobby is hosting a public information event on the future of nuclear energy in Utah. Tim Kalachik serves as the research director at the Utah Office of Energy Development and will be one of the guests at the event. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning. Thanks for joining us, Tim.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So what role do you realistically see nuclear energy playing out in Utah over the next 10 to 20 years?
Over the next 10 to 20, what I would expect to see, and this will be up to industry and our local utility and the legislature, of course, would be some amount of nuclear reactors coming to the state, some amount of nuclear industry coming to the state. Various parts of the supply chain should expand. I would expect workforce training programs with our schools and our universities to expand, and for us to have some amount of power generated on the grid.
So what makes Utah uniquely positioned or not for nuclear development compared to other states?
Generally, it's a little bit more of a knot than it has been a should. We have got an exceptionally supportive governor. We have got an exceptionally supportive legislature. And in the office's interactions with the communities, we've had an exceptionally supportive community. There are obviously concerns, and we love those. We love to hear from the community and hear feedback. But that support is really the core of what makes nuclear enticing within Utah at a commercial scale. But there are other places that have existing commercial nuclear reactors. So they've got an existing workforce. They've got these existing training pipelines. Utah is sort of starting from not quite zero, but not too far past zero. We've got some nuclear industry in the state, some low-level waste disposal, manufacturers who work with the nuclear industry, and then the University of Utah does have a program and a research reactor, which are all fabulous. But that is not quite the same as having reactors and a workforce and that sort of learned public acceptance over those decades.
Well, it seems like we've been saying no nukes for decades. So why nuclear and why now?
Oh, that's a very complicated question. But to give it as shortly and succinctly as I can, and if you come to the event, you'll get some of this, or if you ask a question in the audience, you'll get some of this tonight as well. But the grid, the electrical grid is changing. There has been a large amount of solar and wind added to the grid. There's a lot of battery being added to the grid, and that is fabulous. That is an evolution that is needed. That's a modernization. But it is coming at a time where the more traditional baseload generators like your natural gases and your coals are becoming a smaller share of your total energy mix. And that causes complications in your actual operation of your grid. You need the whole thing to be balanced. It matches demand and generation perfectly. And doing that without, they call them dispatchable resources, is really difficult. So nuclear is sort of seeing a resurgence right now, particularly targeting that dispatchable demographic on the grid. But there's a bunch of advanced nuclear that is having many, many advances that promise a whole range of things, including better operation within the grid, which makes it more flexible and able to fill multiple roles.
Yeah. So, I mean, has anything changed in recent years that's made nuclear energy more attractive to our policymakers and our utility companies?
Yeah. So the general changes to the system, absolutely, that has happened. But then that's maybe more on the sort of regulation side. You can think of it that way. Or on the systems needs side is how I might talk about it. But there have been fundamental shifts coming from essentially private industry out of research. The United States has not pursued nuclear very heavily in the past, several decades at the very least. But research has continued here. The United States and Idaho National Lab in particular is like a world leader in nuclear research. So research has been ongoing since nuclear energy's inception. And that has now reached a point, along with material science and along with sort of people's concern around the grid, around reliability, and around climate and cleanliness and all of these things, to where nuclear is now an extremely attractive table. And there is private industry sort of driving this field forward in what you might hear called small modular reactors, micro reactors, or Gen 4 reactors is how they're sort of categorized. And this is this new fleet that has a whole range of benefits and is actively being developed right now.
I want to get back to that, but how much electricity does the U.S. Sure. already get from nuclear energy?
It varies year by year. I believe the most recent is about 19% of the total electricity generation is nuclear. And if you do that by a clean and non-emitting generator, it has been traditionally about half or more.
And again, none of that's being produced in Utah at this point.
No. Utah has one nuclear reactor, two now actually. If people are following the news and they saw the Valor Atomic Reactor down at San Rafael, but those are test reactors. Those do not produce power. They are for research exclusively.
All right. And these small modular reactors you just talked about, these micro reactors, how do they factor into Utah's strategy compared to these traditional large nuclear power plants that we know of, like San Onofre?
Right. So a large reactor, if you have the suitable environment for it, is an excellent option for an energy generation choice. But Utah, this will be no surprise to anyone listening in, has a bit of a water issue. Traditional nuclear uses quite a bit of water. It requires a lot of throughput. Nuclear energy puts off so much heat and is so dense that the traditional ways to cool it have essentially been pull a bunch of water out of a river. That'll be called a withdrawal. Cycle it through your system. It does not contact anything radioactive. It is perfectly safe. It is just a heat transfer mechanism, and then put that back into the river a couple degrees warmer to sort of keep the entire system working and cool and stable and generating power. Cooling systems are I'll talk about that a little bit more tonight, but I won't get into those details now. That's the traditional system. The small modular reactors, by virtue of a change of technology and a change of just size in general, are open to alternative cooling solutions. So air cooling is the most popular one. You can do other things depending on a bunch of different technologies. But air cooling says, okay, that river that you were gonna use to cool your entire system to dump heat into, we can actually just do that with the atmosphere. We can just do that with air instead. With traditional nuclear, that would be extremely hard and extremely expensive. It would take a ton of land to take that much heat and put it into air cooling. So it has been economically prohibitive. But the small modular reactors, with their smaller size and with advancements in the technologies, have sort of advanced to the point where in an arid state like Utah, where water is an absolute premium, you can pursue solutions that typically use much less water or effectively no water at all. That is also, I'll caveat that a little with that is an understanding that those technologies are not deployed in the United States. That is at the very least the thought and the design and the direction that these small modular reactors are moving.
Well, so as we know, in a state with water constraints, Utah being the second driest state in the country, are we moving forward with these sort of cooling and water cooling plants?
Yeah, I could say that conclusively. That is what has the highest interest from the state, from every interaction I have had with the legislature, with other executive branches. Everyone is very interested in these technologies. And I'll, one other comment on that, it is part of the regulation for siting these facilities. If you don't have enough water to keep safe, guaranteed operation, you won't be able to build one in the first place. So it's part of these early assessments that go on. Nuclear is a famously regulated industry, and that includes all the way down to siting. So before you can even build, you are assessing your water, you're assessing your cooling needs with the specific technologies you're choosing to make sure that it'll actually work out and be safe and reliable.
Yeah, but what does that do to the river habitat? I mean, if it's a water-cooled plant. And the reason I know is because, hey, San Onofre used to be the best place to surf because the water was so warm.
Yeah, if it's done properly, the impact is supposed to be minimal. It's supposed to be essentially net zero. But certainly degrees of warming into the river does matter. That should be monitored. That should be tracked. If the water gets too hot, that's coming back into rejection, certainly will change, at the very least change, or could be damaging to the ecosystem that's being replaced into. You hope to never get there.
Yeah. As we know, data centers and artificial intelligence driving massive new electricity demand. So how significant is that in Utah's energy planning?
It's hard to pin down. It's a little bit of a ghost in the system, if you will. It has the potential to be orders of magnitude larger than what the state uses sort of endemically from our populace, from our existing industry. That's how much power these data centers have, particularly if you look into a class called hyperscalers, which the state uses about 4.5 gigawatts of energy. There are single data center campuses who want to be using a gigawatt or more. They're planning for that. So tens of percents of the state energy at a single location to serve a single data center power user, to do, you know, to power phones, to power jobs, XYZ. That presents an extremely interesting opportunity that the world really has not seen before, that the industry has not seen before, that these data centers, they've got different profiles of generation. They need different energy at different times, but by and large, they are online 24/7. They want to be up essentially 100% of the time, which means whatever power you need to be providing with them needs to match that, needs to be online 100% of the time as well. But given the size of the demand of these data centers, they are so large that that capacity just doesn't exist. It's incredibly hard to serve that much load in one location. So the past couple of years, I've actually seen an evolution of regulation, of different processes, of different maybe infrastructure and different solutions to be able to solve this much power to these users who are more than willing to pay the cost for this energy, but there just is not the energy. Nuclear is extremely well suited to that sort of profile, and it lines up with a lot of their climate or environmental or green goals as well, which certainly you maybe pay a premium for, but good environmental stewardship shouldn't be a partisan issue by all means.
Yeah. Well, you've seen the news about the Military Installation Development Authority, or MIDA, planning to build data centers in Utah's Box Elder County. So why is MIDA the right state entity to play such a big role in Utah's nuclear push?
I would suspect I can't comment on specific projects. We're certainly not privy to all of those objects. The office is primarily a policy office. We're not regulatory. So I don't actually have a bunch of inside knowledge on those developments. But what I can say in general is it's probably because MIDA is willing to work with them. MIDA is willing to reach out. They have the land. They certainly must think they have the ability. It is a procedural issue within data centers. Their number one siting priority, I've heard from multiple data center builders, developers, is speed to power. So they see an advantage in going with MIDA in being able to build faster or get online faster would be, I would suppose, at the end of that. But I do not know for sure.
Yeah. Well, uranium, which is my understanding, the primary fuel used in nuclear energy production, has a half-life of more than 700 million years, making it, of course, a long-lived radioactive waste. How do we know it's safe? Just by putting it in a stainless steel container and burying it?
Sorry, could you repeat that question? How do we know it's safe?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, with a half-life of more than 700 million years.
It's a very interesting philosophical question, if you will. You can go look at many, many debates from people who are far more involved in this process than I am on how do you denote the landscape to tell a generation, not several million years, a couple hundred years, a couple thousand years in the future, that there is a dangerous material buried here and you should not dig it up just in case. It's a fascinating field. I don't know that anyone has a necessary answer there. Solving over millions of years is incredibly difficult. But what we have seen from the spent nuclear fuel cask, dry cask storage is what is sort of done right now. You take your fuel out of the reactor and it starts to change the reactor physics. You put it in a pool, it cools down, and then you pull it out and you put it inside a big old cask. It's got cement, it's got steel. We can sense radiation. So not only are these casks tested rigorously, it's an international standard. They're tested for years and years. You can see videos online of them being dropped onto spikes and the trucks carrying them crashing into barriers, and the cask is fine. They're designed to be incredibly resilient to avoid any spent nuclear fuel getting into the environment for that exact reason. But we can sense these things. So if the spent nuclear fuel was leaking or getting into the environment somehow, that would be a trackable issue. And it has not happened so far. The Earth is incredibly good at preventing radiation from getting into the environment. There's radiation around us at all points in time. There have been nuclear reactors within the Earth itself, actually, just from the geology that's happened there. And it took us decades to find them because the Earth is so good at containing radioactive particles.
Yeah, I mean, safe even in an earthquake prone area?
Yeah, they're designed for that. So that would go down to the design of the concrete pad that these casks sit on. It would be part of that design. Maybe you're not putting them above ground. Maybe they sink into the ground a little bit to make sure that they don't fall over, for instance, in an earthquake case. But that would be part of the design. Seismicity is part of every nuclear building, every facility's design.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, the likelihood of a power plant, you know, going awry is fairly low. I mean, we know the consequences could be disastrous. Of course, some of us remember the Chernobyl disaster in 1986 when it released large quantities of radioactive material. Of course, the Fukushima, Japan nuclear disaster in 2011. And I think, I mean, is nuclear power really worth the risks?
I would posit yes. I would say the few disasters we have, Chernobyl is absolutely an outlier. Worst catastrophe within the nuclear industry, within commercial nuclear development. There's many, many shady practices behind it, but at the end of the day, it did happen. So there is that potential. It's not an unreasonable thought to think, but could Chernobyl happen here? The counter to that you would typically hear is Three Mile Island within the United States, which is our worst commercial nuclear disaster, but calling it a disaster is a bit of a misnomer. The safety systems worked. The plant was shut down successfully, the redundancies kicked in, and even though the area was evacuated from studies done now, it feels like they probably didn't even have to evacuate. There was no actual danger to the populace. They did it out of an abundance of caution. That is the way nuclear regulation is handled in the United States. It is taken seriously. It comes down to community planning. It comes down to community engagement. Training for the state, training for local police officers, for response teams. There's emergency evacuation plans. There are many, many layers of redundancy built into the system that I believe makes it safe. And certainly it shows up statistically. Nuclear is statistically the safest generation resource. It's basically tied with solar. Effectively, the only deaths you get, even counting disasters, are within like mining industry sort of circumstances. So certainly it's designed to be extremely robust. It's designed to be extremely safe. And that is backed up by the decades of generation we sort of have globally. But people are aware and focus in on these disasters because that's maybe the only often thing you've heard of. And that's a fair concern.
Okay. Tim, I'm out of time, but I want to remind people that the Wasatch Back chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby and the Utah Office of Energy Development bringing together state energy experts like Tim, as well as local residents for an evening of learning. They'll take your questions. It's happening tonight, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Blair Education Center at Park City Hospital. I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
That's Tim Kowalczyk, again, Research Director at the Utah Office of Energy Development. Well, the Figure Skating Club of Park City presents a Frozen Adventure for its spring show. In the studio with details, I have cast members Dash William, Austin Knight, and Vivian Fajera, along with one of the parent organizers, Courtney Johansson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Courtney, we'll start with you, and just you can give us the details about where and when the performances are.
Hey, yeah, so we've got a Frozen Adventure on Ice. Show times are Friday night at 7 p.m. We've got a matinee on Saturday at 3, and then another night show at 7 on Saturday night.
Okay, and all at the Park City Ice Arena.
Yep.
All right, how many skaters do you have performing?
We have about 80 skaters performing, so it's quite a production, all the way 3 years old all the way until 18. So we've got a wide variety of skill levels, and it's going to be pretty awesome.
Yeah, so does everyone in this, the club perform?
Not everybody, but a lot. We've got all the way from Learn to Skate to our national development team members. So, you know, a couple of our coaches have been touring with Disney on Ice in the past, so the production quality of this is always phenomenal. And they wanted me to mention we've got the most triple jumps of any production, any show in the state. So we've got some really high-level skaters, but also very cute little skaters as well.
Awesome. Okay. Let's see. Austin, it sounds like this is based on the Disney film Frozen?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So let's what positions are you playing? What roles?
I just have the first role I play is the Ice Harvester. We have a big group of us doing a fun production. And the number is super cool, and it's going to be the most advanced number, I'd say. And then I also play the magical snowman that the two sisters build together, and I am with them for their journey through Frozen on Ice. It's super fun.
Yeah. So are you one of those that are attempting triple jumps?
I'm not, but the people I skate with are.
Awesome. Okay. And Dash, how about you? What are some of the roles you're being taken on?
I'm also the Ice Harvester, and yes, the number is super fun. There's also some cool lifts in there. I'm also the younger sister's love interest, and I help her through her frozen adventure on ice to find her older sister.
Okay, and what about you? What are some of the jumps you're doing? Are you doing any lifts at this point?
Some lifts and some triple jumps. We'll see.
Awesome. Okay. And then how about you, Vivian?
I am the younger version of the older sister, and me and my younger sister build a magical snowman together.
Okay. All right. So how many years you've been skating, Vivian?
I've been skating for about 3 years.
Okay. And how about you two?
I've been skating for 13 years.
I've been also skating for 13 years.
Okay, so this is something you guys are serious about.
Yeah. Yep, yeah. Definitely.
Uh-huh. I mean, what are the opportunities for you kind of going forward?
Well, since I'm a junior in high school, I have one more year to kind of figure out what I want to do after I graduate. And as of right now, I think I'm planning on auditioning for Disney on Ice. But also, if that doesn't work out, then I want to skate collegiately in college with a team.
Awesome. And how about you, Dash?
Right now, I'm moving up a level from my old level, and so I have longer programs, new programs, and, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, can you make a life's career out of skating, or is at some point you just, kind of your body wears out?
That's what I'm really hoping to do.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. How long have you guys been rehearsing this?
For, like, 2 weeks, I think.
Okay.
So they have a pretty extensive, it's a short period of time, but they're on the ice 3 or 4 afternoons a week right now, in addition to their morning training that they all do for their individual careers. But they've been practicing intensively for 2 weeks straight, the 3 hours after school, to kind of get this all nailed down.
Wow. How early do you get there in the morning?
This morning, most of us get there at like 5, and we skate from 5:30, the sessions go till 9:30, so we can skate as many hours or as little hours as we want. So I usually skate 1 to 2 hours every morning, 5:30 to 7:30.
Yeah, you too?
I usually skate from 6:30 to 9:30.
That's impressive, you guys. Let's see, tickets are available online?
Yeah, we sent the link, you guys should have the link. We still have plenty of tickets available, good tickets. You know, we are doing 3 shows this year. There are VIP tables that we're also selling that are on the ice, so you can be right up in the action.
On the ice?
On the ice. We've got tables set up on the ice.
Do they just slide around or what?
No. We put mats. I mean, we try and make it safe, yeah. You know? But yeah, it's a cool sort of immersive experience. But, you know, this is, you know, I'm Vivian's mom, so this is my 3rd year doing this. But the production of this is just, it's insane. It's the what they can pull off in this short amount of time and the quality of it. I just, it's like being at a Disney on Ice show.
Okay, and then the general admission seats are just in the...
In the stands. Exactly. Okay. Friday night, there are chairs on the ice. And then Saturday night, there are tables on the ice. And then the bleacher seating. There's not a bad seat in there.
Okay, dress warmly, I guess.
Absolutely. Dress warm.
Okay, and anything else you want people to know about?
That this show is really fun. We put a lot of work into it. We'd love to have everybody come out and watch us skate, and I think you will be really entertained.
Okay. Costumes, do you buy those or do you just have them?
So I've been in charge of the costumes. It's over 200 costumes because all of these guys have at least 2 parts. Some of them have 3 parts. So it's a combination of efforts with the, you know, we've got skate moms with sewing machines and... piecing stuff together from Amazon. We're, you know, stoning costumes that come. We're kind of doctoring up and making them fancier. So, you know, it's all within a budget as well. So, but yeah, it's been a fun task that I've taken on this year for sure.
Okay, anything else you guys want to say? No? All right. Come see the show again Friday at 7, Saturday at 3, and then Saturday again at 7 p.m. And people can just Google Park City Ice Skating Club, but Figure Skating Club of Park City.
But and it's on the social media and the Facebook and all the things. So.
Okay, Courtney, Austin, Vivian, Dash, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Good luck. Well, Peace House will receive $500,000 in federal funding to bolster its services to sexual assault and domestic violence survivors in the Wasatch Back. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more about that.
Peace House Executive Director Kendra Wyckoff says the nonprofit is excited to use the rural grant to support survivors.
We are really, really proud of this effort because this took a lot of organizing and work with our community partners. It is a 3-year grant for $500,000. It's the first time that Peace House has actually received a direct grant from the Department of Justice Office on Violence Against Women.
Peace House's budget for fiscal year 2024 was about $4 million. The grant aims to reduce some of the hurdles preventing survivors in rural areas from accessing help, including long travel distances, language barriers, and service gaps. Peace House is the only comprehensive victim services provider in the Wasatch Back. With the grant, Wyckoff says the nonprofit is collaborating with many other agencies. Wasatch Forensic Nurses is one key partner. Executive Director Dana Thomas says her organization's trained nurses help survivors get the medical care they need and collect evidence in case they choose to press charges.
That evidence is then turned over to law enforcement so they can investigate the crime, and then the crime lab processes that evidence, and then hopefully perpetrators are held accountable.
She says specialized exams are especially important for victims of strangulation. When injuries aren't easily visible, forensic nurses can request more imaging and advocate for extra care.
Our nurses are trained in that. The advocates are trained on a lot of that. And law enforcement is also receiving training in those areas.
Every time law enforcement officers respond to a domestic violence call, they are required to assess the risk of deadly violence. That includes asking victims if their partner has ever tried to choke them. Officers in the Wasatch Back are trained to call Peace House if a victim is at high risk. The federal grant will help survivors find transportation, navigate the court system if they choose, work with a bilingual translator, and more. It will also enable the nonprofit to provide training about human trafficking. Peace House Chief Program Officer Liz Watson says the nonprofit is partnering with the Asian Association of Utah.
We are at a crux point in when you think about our transportation routes with the interstates of the I-15, the I-80, etc. So there's a lot that goes on in tiny towns like Park City that does involve human trafficking, unfortunately.
Peace House's 24-hour helpline is available at 1-800-647-9161. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.